binary companions, rotation, episodic, non-uniform winds, pulsations, wave transport of angular momentum and energy, nuclear burning shells, 3D convection, magnetic fields, iron cores about to collapse, and then perhaps LIGO events. These are some of the topics that we're going to be talking about today. I'm certainly not going to cover all of them, but I'm going to cover some facets of this bonanza of frontiers. A bonanza of frontiers. Is it really? Let's check. This is a histogram covering the past 22 years of papers that have the words massive star in the title. You may choose other metrics, you'll come up with the same general result. And you can see that there's been a steady growth of papers that have massive star in the title. The growth rate, if you fit that to a line, is about 7%, and this is about twice as large as the general inflation rate of the AAAS journals. So we do have a bonanza of frontiers. We're outpacing inflation, so there is growth in the field. This is good. And in fact, as of yesterday, in 2017, massive star papers in the title are on track for a banner year. Okay. So what I want to talk about is a couple of the trends that have been occurring in the past couple of years. And of course, I have a bias. Some of this is going to focus on some of the work that my group has done over the last couple of years. But it's part of some of these trends that we're seeing in the last couple of years. So one of those trends is ever larger ensembles of 1D stellar evolution models. There's a couple of the practitioners listed there. And a lot of this work is aimed at putting theoretical error bars, theoretical variances, on what we know. So my point of putting the table up here is not the numbers per se, but we're arriving at the point where you can say some statistically rigorous things about the variances that you get in the models. So I'll focus on one of those very briefly, which is going to be Rob Farmer's work, where this is an example of some of the ensembles that we run. So I have three examples of ensembles I want to show here. So this is this was done with four masses, five nuclear reaction networks, as shown in this figure here, and also five mass resolutions. So we want to take a look at how do the properties of a massive star vary with respect to the number of isotopes that you have in your reaction network, and what is the sensitivity with respect to the spatial resolution. These were done with and without mass loss, and they covered from the pre-main sequence all the way to core collapse. Okay? And the plot here is, of course, showing in the NZ plane the various networks that were used. One of the results that you get out of this are heat maps. This is a heat map of the helium core mass. So that's the colors. Colors are giving you the magnitude of the helium core mass. On the x-axis is the number of isotopes that you have in your network. The y-axis is the spatial resolution in solar masses of your model. There are some general trends within this helium core mass. One of the ones that strikes your eye is that rather sharp bifurcation in the helium core mass. It is most prominent perhaps in the 15 solar mass, the 25 solar mass. And I should say one other thing. The top line there is for stars with no mass loss. That's the top four plots. And the second four plots is for stars with mass loss. So we're taking a look at the effects of mass loss as we go on here. And whether you don't have mass loss or you do have mass loss, you see this bifurcation across a spatial resolution. And this is due to the layered semiconvection convection layer that occurs as the hydrogen core begins to recede. And it's a binary decision happens whether that layer penetrates or not, either the hydrogen burning core or the hydrogen burning shell. If it does penetrate it, that's a binary decision, yes or no, did you? Then you're bringing more fresh hydrogen fuel, and this increases the core mass. And so that's why you see that very sharp bifurcation there. Okay? There's a whole lot of other results that you can get out of this work, and I'm going to leave that to Rob Farmer's talk. He'll be talking on Wednesday, and he has a lot more results with what kind of results do you get out of this kind of a sensitivity analysis. Another topic on this ensemble of 1D stellar evolution models is to ask this question. Okay, this is another axis of your variation of putting theoretical error bars on what you're doing. So how do the properties of massive stars evolve from the main sequence vary with respect to the experimental uncertainties in the nuclear reaction rates that you're using? So if I sum up all my experimental variations, what do I get? What's the change in that? To do that, you need a tool. One of the tools that comes into this is something called StarLib. And StarLib is currently the first, and it's the only toolkit that offers a Monte Carlo Bayesian probability distribution function for your reaction rates due to experimental uncertainties. This is an example of one. This is for the helium-3 alpha gamma. This is the reaction rate. There's your probability as you're sampling along. That's the red curves. You can fit that red curve with a log normal distribution. And with three parameters, you can describe the log normal distribution and the variance that you get due to your experimental uncertainty. Okay? So that's tool one. Is StarLib. And within the work I'm going to show you, I just want to mention, since this is unpublished, it's still under review in RevMod Phys, but there's been a new reevaluation of the very important C12 alpha gamma reaction rate. This is from Debourg et al., 2017, as a function of temperature. This is the reaction rate normalized to a work done in 1999, the NACRE. Okay. So the main point of this reevaluation of this rate is a much smaller uncertainty about the value. That's the red curve. Okay. That's the one I want to concentrate on. In some cases, it's a little bit lower. In some cases, it's a little bit higher because of taking account into some of the higher resonances that occur in this particular reaction, but the baseline punch here I want to get is A, there is a new evaluation out, and B, the uncertainty about the value is smaller. Elliot?
New experiments or new theory, or what is
this? This is a combination of new experiments and a new reevaluation within our matrix theory on what the rate is. So some new measurement, mainly a much larger look at taking across the measurements and then reevaluating them. So we have a tool that will give us probability distributions for our reaction rates. We have some nice new reduction in the uncertainties in particular rates. And then you can take those and you can put them in, for example, MESA, and spin it. And so this is an example of 1,000 models, stellar models done with MESA and StarLib. And within this, we're varying about 500 reaction rates within the models. Okay? So the particular plot here is I'm going to be varying C12 alpha gamma. This is my Monte Carlo sampled rate. I divide that by what the recommended or the median rate is. And then there is a factor here that takes care of the temperature dependence of the uncertainty. That's almost essentially unity, and so you're really just looking at a ratio of your sample rate to your median rate. And then on the y-axis is what is the carbon-12 in the center of the star? Okay, so not surprisingly, for C12 alpha gamma, there's a very sharp trend in the line that goes through, as you would expect for C12 alpha gamma. At any given reaction rate, the vertical spread, this is a scatter plot, the vertical spread is the variance that you get from all the other reactions that are not C12 alpha gamma. Okay, so it's telling you the relative importance of reactions besides C12 alpha gamma on the trend. Okay, and so this is at helium depletion. Okay, as you go. So this particular work is done by Carl Fields, who's currently a graduate student out at MSU with Sean Couch. And so in this work, we carry these massive stars from the main sequence to very near collapse and to bring it closer to our bonanza frontiers. We took a look, took it all the way down to the compactness parameter, as it's called, at oxygen depletion. So the compactness parameter, for those who are not familiar with it, it's basically a measuring the depth of the gravitational potential well. This is M over R. And that's evaluated at a mass point that corresponds to roughly the maximum mass of a neutron star. Okay? So M over R evaluated at 2.5 solar masses. That's one definition. There are other definitions of that that we'll hear about. Some of the talks that will be forthcoming, you may just see that abbreviated as zeta 2.5. Okay? So I thought I would say a little bit about what zeta 2.5 is. Again, you're sampling across the C12 alpha gamma rate. There's less of a trend in the compactness parameter, but there's an overall spread of roughly about 0.08, 0.1 in your compactness parameter at oxygen depletion. Okay. The third example that I want to show on ensembles of stellar models is this kind of a summary plot of compactness parameters and explosions. Okay, so let's take a look at the top plot to start. That is the compactness parameter. So you know what that is now. It's M over R in this canonical definition, M over R, evaluated at 2.5 solar masses. The lines there are different estimates of below the line is easy to explode, above the line it is harder to explode. I've got a couple of data sets there. I've got TUG's 2014-2016 curves shown in cyan there. And then I have some unpublished work, some new work done by Ilka Peterman for both low resolution and high resolution without mass loss compared to those. So up to, take your choice, somewhere around 24 or so, okay? The effect of mass loss is not too important. There's obviously a big gap at the higher masses, okay, which is a measure of how important mass loss is for the compactness parameter of these stars. The bottom part of this plot is an incomplete but representative survey of the explosion community's models. Okay, so if it is in red, it did not explode. If it is in white, it exploded, and the symbol gives the spatial dimensionality of the calculation. So for example, take 15, that's one of the more common ones on this plot, and you can see that there's a variety of results. Sometimes they explode, sometimes they don't in 2D. Or 1D. A nice shot over here is at 28 solar masses. All of the multi-D calculations explode in agreement with a mass loss driven compactness parameter as opposed to without mass loss. Another trend that you can see on here is all of the 3D explosions explode. All of the 3D ones go boom. 2D, maybe. 1D. Yeah, it's 1D. Okay. So that's an example, three examples of the trend that you can see in recent publications on ensembles of stellar models.
But the 3D explosions are the same group, or is it different
groups? No, different groups. Different groups. So I don't know if you can read it on this, but we have a host of different authors who are in the explosion community blowing stuff up. And different results among different groups. I think it's a fair way to say that. Okay. Oh, easy. Okay. So that was some ensembles. And now I want to sort of do a little bit future look on within the last year or two where there's been some work and what I think will probably be some developing trends over the next couple of years for sure. Okay, so one of those is the following. So probably most of you all know that beyond carbon burning, your neutrino, you're dominated by neutrino cooling. It's not photons, it's neutrinos. And certainly by the time you get to oxygen burning, you've got a ferocious neutrino cooling term going on. So the idea that has popped up in the last year or two, particularly as the neutrino detectors get ever more sensitive, is could you begin to probe the final stages of massive star evolution with neutrinos? Okay. And so what this plot is showing, this is one of the examples, this is from Kelly Patton, fired off in 2016, and then she's got another work coming out in 2017. George Fuller has been recently involved in this one. So this is the top plot here is a plot of the central density on the x-axis and the temperature on the y-axis, so the rho T diagram. The yellow track there is the track that a 15 solar mass MESA model will follow. There's a couple of landmarks in this plot shown. There's the oxygen ignition curve, there's a silicon ignition curve. The Fermi energy divided by KT equals 4 is roughly a degeneracy line. Okay. And along every point on this evolution, all the way up till you get to core collapse, where you either have iron photodisintegration or you've got rapid electron capture going on, you want to compute the neutrino rates that you would get, both from weak reactions and from thermal neutrino losses. Okay? Everything above the gray curve currently is potentially detectable by neutrino detectors. And so I show an example right as you cross sort of the oxygen burning threshold, and then one right before as you get to collapse. Okay. And so and just a reminder, the oxygen burning takes place roughly on order of magnitude about 6 month time scales. So there's a possibility of detecting some of these well before the actual event goes on. And that's kind of the goal of this whole work, is to probe the late stages of massive star evolution with neutrinos.
What distance is it
That's the experimental question. That's not what's shown here. This is just the raw rate coming out at those temperatures and density conditions. We have not put this out at some distance yet. That would be a sensitivity and an observable.
It must be in our galaxy.
Yes. Yes. But that's where the next works are going, are doing exactly the plot you just mentioned, where we're at. So, this is another trend I think you're going to see over the next couple of years. I'm sure there are several groups working on this. And this is the idea of 3D element factories. This is a shot of CASE from New Star and Chandra. You know, our astronomy textbooks will say that massive stars drive a large portion of the periodic table. And yet, our most advanced 3D explosion calculations use 13 isotopes, maybe 21 isotopes, okay? So this yawning gap between 13 isotopes and the periodic table is driven in part by the choice to always put the ever-increasing computer resources into spatial resolution and not isotopes, okay? So, and I remind you that almost everything we know about the 1D detail nucleosynthesis comes out of 1D models, right? So how would the 1D models fit to 3D physics? So what if we took, following Robert Frost, the road less traveled. That's what we came up with in about 2015, 2016, where the idea is to combine a stellar evolution code like MESA with a 3D code like FLASH So we want to take the MESA models of pre-main sequence, evolve them up to maybe oxygen burning, map those into a 3D hydrocode, and then in parallel follow the evolution of each one. 3D flash, 1D MESA, and compare the output at various points. How does a 3D calculation look at the onset of core collapse? How about at the end of the explosion? How about at the end when the nucleosynthesis is all over? And then loop that back through a myriad of observations that you have and iterate. Okay. So the first step in doing this was to see, does this even pass the giggle test? Would a 3D, or does 3D make any difference to the explosion or not? Okay? To heck with the 100 isotopes yet, right? We just want to take a look at, you know, does this have an effect? So we took a 21 isotope, 15 solar mass MESA model at silicon shell burning, so relatively close in this work. And this was mapped into the same 21 isotope network into 3D flash. And we spun it. And so these, at the time, in 2015, these were the first 3D simulations of core collapse and the growth of the iron core. So what's shown here is three snapshots at three different times shortly after the model is mapped in to where core collapse is about to happen. And there, the quad chart here shows different quantities. So in the upper left is the silicon 28 mass fraction. On the right, in the upper right quad, is the velocity, the speed of the material. You have the energy generation on the lower left, and on the lower right is iron. Okay. So the punchline to take away from the pretty colors is that by the time you get to the end, you are decidedly non-spherical. You have convective speeds that are moving at about 500 kilometers per second, which is a significant fraction of a typical collapse velocity of about 1,000 kilometers per second. So this is taking it up to the point of collapse. And then, of course, then the punchline is, after we put this in and did a exploratory neutrino explosion calculation on it, is that the stronger turbulence from a non-spherical progenitor, that's the upper plot, the yellow curve is a lot bigger and a lot wider from a 3D calculation than what you get from a 1D calculation. And that enhanced turbulence enhances, because now the convection is rolling as opposed to just being quiescent, increases what we the diagnostic explosion energy. That's this plot here. This is a time after bounce. We do two calculations here, full 3D, and then we do one where we angle average it. Okay, so we're trying to wipe out the 3D effects and make it, in effect, one-dimensional. Okay, and so once the silicon shell accretes through the shock, yellow curve goes up, and so this enhances the explosion by having sort of, if you like, the turbulence has been preceded as it goes through. I think over the next coming years, I think you're going to see several groups go after 3D nucleosynthesis. There's already been some shots fired out from Tomas and the German group. There's some efforts going on with Sam Jones and company. And so I think the era of 3D nucleosynthesis is upon us. Where we are in this project right now is I have taken what we want to put in. This is what we call a 100 isotopes project. I have a 126 isotope network. I have defanged it, and I have put it into Sean Couch's version of Flash, and the early calculations are running right now. So I think a number of groups you're going to be seeing 3D nucleosynthesis coming out. And with that, I'll open it up for comments and discussion amongst ourselves.
Thank you so much. Questions? Pablo.
Do all these uncertainties in rates play any role in Big Bang nucleosynthesis as well?
In Big Bang nucleosynthesis?
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't solve the lithium problem, Okay, so let's get that out of the way. but yes, in fact, this was one of the first applications that we did with StarLib, was going after Big Bang nucleosynthesis and what is the effects of that. Mm-hmm, absolutely. That's an easy one because Big Bang nucleosynthesis is so easy. No big bangers here, okay.
This may be just to stir up Thomas, but it was not my impression that all 3D calculations blew up.
Thomas!
You talk as if we had done 3D calculations for 10 years and still have a problem. I mean, we started to do 3D about 2 years ago, and we have the very first models out. So, I mean, how many progenitors, how many cases did we run? There's a 15 solar mass case with Oak Ridge. There is a 20 solar mass and a 9 solar mass case, 9.6 in our group, and a couple of others which we haven't published yet. Yeah, I mean, we are starting to doing it, and this kind of compilation of explosions, no explosions, is absolutely meaningless. If you don't talk about the physics which group use, the accuracy of the neutrino physics, the details of the hydrodynamics, the resolution, it's absolutely meaningless. I mean, it's just a compilation of results, and the papers were not put out to advertise explosions. The papers were put out to report progress in the modeling.
Okay. See, yeah, it's so easy to get him going.
Is there a sense whether the 3D nucleosynthesis will matter for the actual yields, as opposed to, you know, producing bullets of this and that? That's clearly important for where things end up.
Right. Right, give me a... All right, that looks 3D. We have jets, we have knots. Don't know yet. That's absolutely one of the things we want to get at, right? When you do this, how much it does come out in bullets, how much comes out in jets, how does the integrated total of that compare to a 1D spherical? It might be fine, it might not, TBD. But I think we'll at least begin to start getting an answer to that over the next year or two as these various groups go after this.
Just a technical question. If you have all those uncertainties in reaction rates, if you wanted to map that on the final core mass of a star, let's say carbon-oxygen core mass, mm-hmm. is it like it would change a result by 10% or more like a core mass by a factor of 2?
Okay. So in the first work of this, that was actually the very first application we did. So this is Carl Fields in 2016, where we took at low-mass star evolution and asked, how does this change the properties of carbon-oxygen white dwarfs? Well, this is massive stars, but we'll talk carbon, oxygen, white dwarfs. And then we took those results and we plotted on the initial mass, final mass diagram and compared how it goes. I'm going to plead with Vicky that I can't necessarily remember everything research-wise that happened in the last year. But my sense is that the variation of that was typically on the order of about a tenth of a solar mass. Okay. Take that with a little bit of grain of salt. Actually look at the paper and see what the number is. I would say another one of the interesting things in that work is that if you take a look at the carbon-oxygen profiles, there's a switch between when it becomes carbon-dominated in the center to oxygen-dominated on the outside. Right? So there's a transition point. And the astereoseismology is sensitive to that transition because it changes the chemical weight as you go through. And so there's some hope that you can get a handle on what's going on those interior profiles in the carbon-oxygen by taking a look at that.
Is there any prospect for using the MESA flash comparison to improve mixing treatments in MESA?
My impression is that there are other groups who are more focused on the actual simulation of convection. Dave Arnett, Casey Meekin and company, Paul Woodward, Falk Herwig. And I would expect that most of how do you adjust or tune or change a 1D convection theory in response to 3D models, I would expect that's more going to come out of that side of the community than what we're doing in particular here.
It's also pretty close to closest,
Yes. Yes.
Yes. So I have a question related to the reaction rates. Have you looked at, you know, there's certain properties like the core mass, compactness that change. Have you done a detailed study? Maybe Rob will talk about this later, about whether or not other effects produce a larger change, like mixing, rotational mixing, overshoot, mass loss, that kind of thing.
Right.
What has a bigger effect?
Right. So of course, there's a lot of free parameters, right? So whether it's spatial resolution, number of isotopes, what your reaction rates are, what your convective boundary mixing is, all these things, and it's just impossible to do it all at once, right? So sort of what I've shown here is taking pieces of it. So whether that be, you know, the stuff that Rob has done or the stuff that Carl has done on varying the reaction rates. I would say that one topic project I would like to get going, definitely, is to answer exactly the question you brought up, right? So what has more weight in sort of the overall uncertainty? Is it the uncertainty in the nuclear reaction rates, or is it the uncertainty in what you take, for example, for overshooting, your convective boundary mixing, this kind of stuff? So I think that's a real natural next axis to go after.
Okay.
And so for the work that we did here, all of the convective stuff was fixed, right?
Yeah.
No change.
So quick follow-up question then, are there any properties that you think you can robustly say change just as a result of the reaction rates and not these other uncertain physics?
Core masses, compactness parameters, as you take it all the way down? Yeah, I think that.
So just to
put it on here, right? I mean, let me answer it, right? What's the total variation here, taken at face value, is on the order of about, you know, 0.1, round numbers, right? And so now compare that to what's here, 0.1 in this meaningless plot I put up here. it's an interesting meaningless plot, but meaningless. So just the nuclear reactions can give you a fairly significant variation on your compactness parameter as you go down. So it's not completely uncertain. Stan?
So how do we know that all these different sources of uncertainty combine linearly, that there is not some feedback effect in between them? Maybe there isn't one that is more important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you got to start somewhere, right? So the first thing you do is you know, do a linear, and then worry about the non-linearities.
So you said like most efforts have been putting into increasing the spatial resolution.
Yes.
Would you think it's worth like including more isotopes as well, like going beyond the 21 isotopes, and how far should we go there?
That was my whole point.
Yeah. How many for the 3D simulation?
Right.
How many can be afforded, and is it worth it?
Right. Yeah, so this has a couple of competing boundary conditions, right? One is just the size of the compute resources you have, right? What is your RAM? How much can you afford on the compute node? And then the other part is sort of a physics part of what isotopes are interesting to the evolution of the late stages of massive stars. And so there's a little bit of an art there. If you're only going to restrict yourself to 50 to 100, 120 isotopes, there's a bit of an art on which ones to pick. I'm an artist. hopefully we can you know, have a fairly good idea of what isotopes will have the biggest effect as you're moving on down. But you're exactly right. There's this trade-off. You're going to be trading off isotopes for spatial resolution if you know, max your machine out to what is the biggest problem you can handle. So we're going to give up a little bit on spatial resolution and put it into some isotopes.
Question by Stephen Smart.
Yeah.
So on your, is this on? Okay. So on this, you've got the feedback loop here with observables. So obviously, for most supernovae, we don't get the quality of data we have for Cas A or 87A. So what are the things that you might think of in comparing? So the things that we can relatively easily measure for extragalactic supernovae are nickel 56, 58 sometimes, the oxygen abundances, magnesium, sodium, calcium in the nebular phase. So those are the sorts of observables we could produce. Are you... have you thoughts about what we should concentrate on for comparisons?
So I think you nailed all the major ones in an integrated quantity, right? And so another axis on that is to go after supernova remnants, where you have some spatial information about what the distribution looks like. It's not just Cassay, there's several supernova remnants you can go after. So I think as far as the quantities go, I think you certainly nailed the major ones, which we would go after. And then also, I mean, do you get anything that looks like a Cassay or Puppis or any of the other supernova remnants? So.
Back to the noise,
we were
a while ago.
The
variability.
Okay.
On your reaction rate plot. Mm-hmm. Tugeldur and I have studied this quite a bit, mm-hmm. too, as you know. And in fact, Zalman Barkat is the person who started this maybe 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he and we think that maybe there's just some chaos, some noise. You've got a star that goes through 6 stages of convection, maybe 4 stages of carbon burning in different shells. Mm-hmm. You've got so many different linearized equations with if tests in them, and if it goes this one zone this way or one zone that way, you go down a different path. So mm-hmm. there's sensitivity to initial conditions in there. So the question is, you know, how much is physical variation and how much is noise, mm-hmm. in the sense of chaos? And so have you tried, I guess this is part of the point of the study, have you tried to isolate the physics from the noise? Things like time step, zoning, switches on convection.
So for example, that's exactly
the compiler you use.
We don't, so yeah, okay, another, that's a different topic. that was exactly the point of what Rob went after. How sensitive are your results to the spatial resolution? And also folded in that. I understand. But also folded in with that spatial is also a temporal within that, right? Because the mass zone sets the time step. So to answer your question directly, have we tried to filter out at what level is numerical noise versus what is physical variation? No, not yet. Okay.
So did you mention the dependence of progenitor models? I think some groups calculate the rotating progenitor model as an initial condition. So how about progenitor rotation?
Do you refer to the explosion calculations?
Yes.
This?
And yeah. Next one.
This one.
You did this one.
This
one. Yeah.
So are some of these rotating and some of these not?
Yeah.
Again, this will get to Thomas's point that this plot is meaningless. It's all meaningless. Okay. Uncertainties of this, and did I investigate this, and I put different things. It's all, you know, it's great. It's absolutely wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
We have a question here.
Thank you. So a question for you as much as for some of the practitioners in the audience. I mean, given that these 3D supernova explosion calculations are pushing the largest machines available, and that coming generations of machines will be far less balanced in terms of memory versus CPU. And given what Thomas was saying, that this plot is meaningless, or that the physics that's included in the small reaction network 3D calculations makes a big difference into whether they explode or not.
Mm-hmm.
How much can we back off on the resolution and maybe other physics in order to include more isotopes and more reactions? How much can we afford?
Uh-huh.
If, say, memory doesn't increase anymore, but CPU gets arbitrarily free.
I can take part of that. I mean, we put in a proposal for exactly this, and we walk through the arguments, and it's that trade-off, right? And so submitted this thing in September, and I can't remember exactly what the numbers are, but there are certain scalings, right? And it's just a matter of whether you choose to do that. And I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. We do this in September, and I can pull it up.
But networks are a very good thing to pass off to GPUs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, they're very zonal intensive physics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, at the end of the day, it is just like a spatial resolution dimension, right?
Who has shown that the size of the network used in whatever phase, I didn't get from your talk, but the size of a network used in the simulations makes a difference in the explosion? Who has shown that? I have not read any such a statement in literature.
Nobody.
Yeah, so I mean, there was somebody saying here in the audience, and some others also took it, as if you wanted to say that the size of the network used for some phase of the evolution, which I actually couldn't conclude which it was, makes a difference in the outcome of a simulation with respect to explosion or not explosion. Nobody has said this.
Not in 3D, agreed. Right. So what we showed, what I showed earlier was for the 1D models, right, where the number of isotopes does have an impact. But you're entirely correct. As far as 3D, no one has shown it yet. So what I did show is just that a non-spherical progenitor has an effect. Whether you have 50 isotopes, 21, 3,040, whether that has any difference on the explosions is a TBD. That's a forefront.
That's what I understood. That's exactly what I understood you saying.
Okay.
And I understood more.
Okay, and hopefully that wasn't a meaningless statement. When we publish this, I'm gonna subtitle this, The Meaningless Plot.
Can I ask you? Can I ask you about the neutrino emission?
Oh yeah, sure. I think this one's kind of fun.
In our own galaxy, but is there a chance to see this as a background from galaxy?
That's another whole area. And so that's what these first couple of four papers are going after, and I think I know of three others in the pipes that are going after exactly this question. How far? What is the background level? What is the sensitivity? So that's why I think this is a forthcoming trend, and all the answers are not in on this yet. But it's an interesting, perhaps complement to the gravitational era of gravitational wave detection, that maybe as we lower the neutrino sensitivity rates, we'll be able to probe the final stages via neutrinos. So,
so just to follow up actually on the distances, the oxygen one, you're looking at kind of Betelgeuse distance, and the core collapse you're looking at maybe a kiloparsec kind of distance.
Nice. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Other topics we want to discuss for topic before coffee.
And I submit this as the picture for the conference. It's my artwork contribution to this.
Well, we had quite some discussion already. I think we should discuss over coffee instead.
Okay.
And we'll be back here at 11 very sharp.